Hi, everybody. Thanks for being here and thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak today. It's really exciting to be here. Today I'm going to talk about what I worked on in the last couple of years, which is the extraction of continuum and relational physics from quantum gravity, more specifically within the Group-free theory approach to quantum gravity, and especially looking for applications in cosmology. As you can imagine, the plan of the talk would be to go from the left-hand side of this diagram to the right-hand side of this diagram. So at the right-hand side of the diagram, we have our macroscopic description of gravity in terms of geometries and space-time-based quantities, while on the left-hand side, we have our microscopic description of gravity, which is our background-independent and quantum gravitational theory, which is based, in principle, on some fundamental degrees of freedom which are not necessarily directly related with our macroscopic quantities. And so we can call them some pre-geometric degrees of freedom. And when we're trying to go from left to right, we're facing several difficulties. And today I'd like to focus on two of them. The first is called the continuum limit problem. So how do we go from our pre-geometric degrees of freedom to our macroscopic quantities? And the second one instead is the localization problem. So how do we localize physical quantities in space and time, especially in a context where space and time have actually disappeared into these pre-geometric degrees of freedom? So in the first part of the talk, there are ways in which we can address these problems. So the most natural way to address the problem of continuum limit is by coarse graining our fundamental degrees of freedom. And instead, the problem of localization can be naturally addressed by implementing a relational strategy. So try and localize internal degrees of freedom with respect to other internal degrees of freedom. So in the first part of the talk, I will try to outline these coarse graining and relational strategies and the difficulties that we're facing in quantum gravity. And I will also advocate for effective approaches to the implementation of these two strategies. But although the discussion will be quite general, I would like to keep in mind group field theories, because in the second part of the talk instead, I will show you how we can implement these effective approaches to coarse graining and relationality and group field theory in order to obtain some cosmological physics. So let me start first by introducing very briefly group field theories. So I will first give you a formal definition of group field theories. Then I will try to show you how these theories are related to quantum gravity, specifically to spin foams and loop quantum gravity. And then I will just summarize the main features of these models. So what are group field theories? Formally, group field theories are theories of a field defined on R copies of a group manifold. Now, R here is the dimension of the space tend to be, so we can think of R to be equal to 4. And G is going to be the local gauge group of gravity. So G is a cell to C, or for some models, as we will see, one can actually restrict to an SU2 subgroup of the SL to C group. So the one important, really important feature of these theories to keep in mind is that interactions of these theories are combinatorially non-local. And with this, I mean the field arguments are convoluted pairwise, following the combinatorial pattern dictated by a certain graph. So this is enforced, for instance, by using these kind of kernels here. Or maybe I should use the analog pointer. These kind of kernels here. And graphically, it's implemented, for instance, by connecting the various legs that represent the field arguments in this kind of diagram. This is an example for an order 5 interaction. So why is this important? And what is the connection with quantum gravity? The thing is that when we look at the Feynman diagrams of these theories, these turn out to be stranded diagrams, which are dual to R-dimensional cellular complexes of arbitrary topology. So we can kind of think of them as discretized, at least pseudo-manifolds. And then when we compute the amplitudes on these diagrams, they turn out to be sums over group theoretic data associated to the cellular complex. And these group theoretic data are data associated to the local gauge group of gravity. So this means that if we choose the kinetic and interaction kernels appropriately, so for instance, to match the desired spinfall amplitudes, what we're obtaining when writing the partition function as a sum over all possible Feynman diagrams, this becomes a definition of a complete spinfall model, or equivalently, a definition of a lattice gravity path integral. So these theories can be connected with simplicial gravity, but we can also try to draw some connections with loop quantum gravity, and this is most easily done by looking at the one particle Hilbert space of these theories, because it turns out that the one particle Hilbert space, once you impose appropriate constraints, is equivalent to the Hilbert space of a quantum titrator. And these constraints are exactly what give us this interpretation in terms of this quanta, fundamental quanta, as simplicial objects. And these are called closure and simplicity constraints. And depending the form that these constraints take is actually what tell us exactly what kind of gravity model we're trying to study with these group field theories. And this can be implemented in different ways. The easiest probably the easiest way to visualize these constraints is by using the Lie algebra representation, where you're associating a Lie algebra element to each of the faces of your quantum tetrahedron, and these B vectors, B quantities here, which are the Lie algebra variables. And once after you impose the constraints, these B quantities will represent by vectors constructed out of tetrad fields discretized over the surface of these triangles that make up the tetrahedron. But there are different representations in which you can work on. For instance, you can work in a Lie group representation, where instead of working with metric variables, you're working with connection variables. So the group variables are actually holonomies of the gravitational connection integrating along edges dual to the faces of these triangles. And of course, you can also work in representation space, which is particularly useful to make a more clear connection with loop quantum gravity, because if you impose simplicity LIPRL and then you manage to reduce your group to an SU2 subgroup and impose constraints, then your one particle states are in fact open spin network vertex spaces. So the fundamental structures that we have in group field theories are very similar to those that appear in loop quantum gravity. However, when you actually construct the full Fock space in group field theory, there are some differences between this space and the different variant Hilbert space of loop quantum gravity. So in general, you can show that the space of states associated to connected simplicial complexes can always be faithfully embedded within the group field theory Fock space. But generic states within the group field theory Fock space do not correspond to connected simplicial lattices, nor to simplicial classical geometries. So these are more generic kind of states. So in a sense, this kind of Fock space is similar to the different variant loop quantum gravity Hilbert space, especially if written in terms of a Fock representation. But it's also different because there's no continuum intuition, and orthogonality is defined in group field theory with respect to nodes, because we've been seeing the one particle state is just one vertex, rather than to graph as it is in loop quantum gravity. Still, you can import a lot of physical information from loop quantum gravity in these theories. For instance, you can construct second quantized versions of the first quantized loop quantum gravity operators, an example of which is the volume operator. And the procedure is the usual one that you would use in standard second quantization. So you just sandwich the matrix elements of your operator between appropriate powers of your field operator. So let's summarize very briefly what is the physical content of these theories. So the quanta of these theories are just R-1 simplices, so in four-dimensional tetrahedra, decorated with quantum geometric data. And the dynamics of this model is defined in such a way that the partition function of these theories provides a definition of a simplicial gravity path integral. Now we can go beyond this and also include matter in these kind of models. And scalar fields are particularly simple, for instance, to couple to these models, because in fact what happens is that you just need to also include data on your one particle quantum numbers that also include the value of the scalar field discretized on the tetrahedron itself. So now your quantum tetrahedra, so your one particle states, encode data which have data which encode quantum geometric and scalar field information. So this can be done also equivalent, you can see this, by enlarging the domain of the group field, so that it now includes not only gravitational data, but also these real variables that are just the values of the scalar field discretized over tetrahedron. And at the level of the dynamics, you still want your partition function to represent a simplicial gravity plus scalar field path integral. And this means that, contrary to what happens for the geometric data that enter non-locally, the scalar field data enter locally in interaction, so they're much simpler to handle. There are some further simplification that that happen for minimally coupled, free, and massless scalar fields, which I'm not going to go into, but these are the kind of fields that we're going to consider from now on, because they're especially simple to couple in these models. All right, so this said, let me spend a few words now on the continuum limit problem and the localization problem and the coarse graining strategy and relational strategy to address these problems.
Can I ask
Sure.
a question?
Yes.
So if you, for GFT amplitudes, if you restrict it to one triangulation or one graph, you get a spectrum amplitude.
Yes, that.
So if you do that with a scalar field, you get a certain discretization of spin form plus scalar field.
That's the idea, yes. That's the idea.
But how? I mean, there are certain interesting details, like how is a scalar field, how does a scalar field, which metric does a scalar field see? Have you worked it out?
Yeah, so there are some. There's one work in which the scalar field is coupled in detail to the simplicial action, and the construction is really so the where these details about how the scalar field is coupled to geometry enter in this kinetic kernel here. Mm-hmm. And not so much in the interaction kernel, but rather in the kinetic kernel. For instance, if these scalar fields are minimally coupled, free, and massless, the only way the scalar field interacts with the geometry is through the propagation term, right? The kinetic term.
Yeah, I mean,
yes.
You define there a certain Laplacian. But
yes, exactly. So you discretize the Laplacian, exactly. So there's going to be in the Laplacian, there's going to be all the terms that include the dual tetrahedron that connects to the values of the two values of the scalar field in the two different force simplices. So that's going to enter here. Uh-huh. And it's going to be depending on the geometric data of the neighboring force simplices.
So it gets quite complicated because
it gets very much very, very complicated, yes.
And you need the B fields, but then you do.
Yes, it is extremely complicated, the form.
Very complicated.
It is very complicated, and that's the reason why I will not show this, but I can tell you already the equations of motion that we write when we actually go to mean field, they're going to be parameterized. So there's going to be some functions, arbitrary functions of these parameters, which we don't go too much into details because they're very complicated functions. But those are the ones that should encode this kind of detail. But yeah, the specific form of those functions has been worked out in the coupling of the model to like formally, but in actual physical applications, those are always being like parameterized. It's never been actually written explicitly.
Thank
you. Okay, so let's talk about this continuum limit problem and localization problem. Let's start from the continuum limit problem. So what does it mean to study the continuum limit in quantum gravity? Well, it means that we should be able to include a large number of our dynamical microscopic degrees of freedom. So in other words, we should be able to compute the full partition function of the theory. Now, computing, if we're able to do that, we should also be able to identify different phases of the theory. So we could have a phase with no continuum interpretation, which we can call a pre-geometric phase, and a phase which instead has this kind of continuum interpretation, and hopefully it matches with a GR phase. But what's the problem here? So what is the problem in computing the full partition function of the theory? Well, the thing is that the best way we know how to compute the partition function is through the randomization group procedure. And doing randomization group in quantum gravity is quite different from doing it in standard quantum field theory on spacetimes. And there are some important difficulties or differences between the two. And here I would like to mention two of them. The first is that one important notion when doing randomization group analysis is the notion of an energy scale, which defines the flow of in your theory space from the IR to the UV or vice versa. But in quantum gravity, we don't have any notion of external time scales, so only internal scales and internal notions of energy are available. So this ties back to the problem of localization of before. So in quantum gravity, IR and UV may have very different meanings than they do in standard quantum field theory on, for instance, a fixed background. On top of that, the reason why the normalization group approach is so effective in standard quantum field theory is because we're considering systems whose symmetries we know quite well. And this constrains very strongly the theory space and helps a lot in running the whole normalization group program. While on the other hand, symmetries of quantum gravity models are much harder to classify. So we have also very little control over quantum gravity space compared to the standard quantum field theory case. So for these reasons, approximate or effective methods are particularly useful because they allow us to gain more mathematical control, which in turn will provide us with more physical insights and possibly will help us better approximations and create a positive feedback loop. So as an example of these approximate methods, I would like to spend a few words on the mean field approximation of the partition function, which is just a fancy way of saying that we're computing the partition function in a subtle point approximation. And this feels quite appropriate to study because it was what, in the end, started the whole normalization group program. So let me very briefly review a standard application of mean field theory for a theory which is local, and it's just a 5^4 theory. So in this case, of course, mean field analysis is just the computation of the classical equations of motion. In general, we see that we have two different solutions for a negative square mass parameter. We have a mean field which is different from zero, while for a positive mass parameter, we have a mean field which is actually equal to zero. And we can see if we look at the behavior of fluctuations over this mean field, we can study the correlation of these fluctuations and see that there's a typical correlation scale, which is called correlation length, which blows up as we go towards the mass parameter going to zero. So the correlations become long range, and this signals a phase transition between the two. So the question is, how good is our mean field description of these two phases? And a natural way to study this is to see what is the impact of fluctuations on the mean field. And there's a parameter that captures this kind of behavior, and it's called the Ginzburg parameter, which essentially is the ratio between the correlations of fluctuations over a certain region characterized by a size, which is the typical order of the correlation length, divided by the mean field squared averaged on the same region. So if this Q parameter is small, then our mean field theory is totally fine because it means the fluctuations have a small impact on our mean field theory. On the other hand, if this Q parameter becomes large, we can't rely on mean field theory anymore. And if you run the analysis in standard 5^4 theory, what you find is that mean field theory breaks down below a certain critical dimension. So in those cases, you will need to actually resort to full randomization group analysis. So let me now try and extend this to group field theories. And let me include one ingredient of complication at a time. So as a first ingredient, let me include non-local interactions. So we're going to consider an arbitrary rank for our group field theory and a very simple group domain, which is just an abelian group. So one thing that we will need to do is that we will need to regularize regularize our group because of the interactions being non-local. So usually what you do in mean field analysis is that you project onto uniform field configurations. And because interactions are non-local, if you project onto uniform field configurations, you're going to find a bunch of empty integrals. So you will need to regularize in order to make sense of all that. But if you, and the regularization you should do that carefully because it turns out that if you don't remove the regulator and go towards the phase transition, what happens is that the phase transition is actually not there. And this is something that we expect also already from standard quantum field theories with local interactions, but it's something that we can also confirm to be the case also here in group field theories with no local interactions. So if we run the same analysis as before, what we find is that the effective dimension from these models is not really just the naive effective dimension, which would be this part here, but rather there's a connection, there's a correction that comes with this parameter, which is S naught. So S naught is called the minimum number of zero modes, and it's essentially counting the number of delta functions that appear in this characteristic operator, which is associated to each of the interactions that you have in your theory. And this enters the effective mass of your fluctuations, and hence enters also the effective dimension. So here's an example for melonic interactions in rank 4. You have this S naught, which is 1, because you just have one delta function. So the interesting thing is that these results were also found exactly in the same way in a functional normalization group of these models. But this is, of course, much simpler because it's just mean field theory. So this is promising. But we can also see that already at this level, there's again a set of parameters for which mean field theory breaks down, as it was in the standard local case. So we can add one more layer of complication going towards more realistic models, which is including matter. And matter is particularly simple because, as we've seen before, they enter locally in interaction. So the effect that they have on the effective dimension is just to increase the value of the effective dimension of this quantity, of the number of scalar fields that we actually have in our theory. So this quantity here. What really changes everything is if we consider a group domain, which is the Lorentz group. So in this case, you will have to perform more careful regularization. But what happens is that the effective dimension actually becomes dependent on the correlation length. And it diverges as the correlation length diverges. So this means that mean field theory is always a good description of the phase transition. And importantly, this seems to be a universal result, because it turns out that it only depends on the hyperbolic nature of the Lorentz group. So it really depends on the Lorentzian properties of our geometries. This is a universal but also surprising feature, because this is very different from what happens in standard quantum field theory on spacetime, on local quantum field theory on spacetime, where we actually have a mean field theory that will break down for certain dimensions.
So it seems a very important result here. Can you expand a little bit more and explain more?
Sure. Do you have like some specific question? Do you want me to?
I mean, why this? Yeah, it's you went very fast, DB, you know, going
yeah.
Infinity with the correlation, then
yeah.
In a matter, you need first a matter system, right?
Yeah, the matter system, in fact, doesn't turn out to be important. So that's
what are the ingredients?
The only important ingredient is that you're working with a group domain which is hyperbolic in nature.
Does it matter what measure you take, or
you mean measuring the R measure of the group,
or the phase, for instance, or the interaction, you know, the propagator?
That doesn't seem to be important. So here we consider just the Barrett-Crane model, but none of the details of the imposition of the constraints, as in the Barrett-Crane case, seem to be important for these results. So one to be absolutely certain that there's no impact of the imposition of the constraints on this result, one would have to also run it for other models. But what really was the overwhelming feature was just that we were working with the Lorentz group, because this Lorentz group has a measure which is in fact exponentially increasing, and these exponentially increasing factors in the end are what determine the fact that this thing here diverges when you go towards the phase transition. So this we realized was the main important ingredient that was needed in order to find this result. But for instance, matter wasn't important, because the contribution of matter is only a constant here, so it doesn't change so much the behavior towards the phase transition, because towards the phase transition, instead, the geometric contribution becomes extremely dominant due, in fact, to these hyperbolic properties.
And so what is the nature of the transition? Is it melonic?
Sorry?
What is the nature of the phase transition? Is it melonic?
Yes. So if you were to look at this, so let's forget about this this geometric thing, because then it's still melonic in the sense that the melonic terms are those that are contributing. because all the other ones are going to be, so here you see, I've shown the Melonic case because it's the one with the dominant S0, so it's the one that has the smallest number of zero modes, and only the interaction terms with the smallest number of zero modes end up being dominating when you actually compute this effective mass, and thus when you compute the effective dimension. So in the end, all of this is also dominated by the Melonic interaction. So yes, yeah, that's exactly right. It's the Melonic interactions which seem to drive this. But still, if we didn't have Melonic interactions, we'll still find a similar behavior, just that it would be scaling a little bit differently. But it doesn't change the fact that the effective dimension will blow up as we go towards the phase transition. So still, Melonic interaction seems to be the dominant one from this perspective. All right, if there aren't any other questions, OK, I'll go towards the localization problem now. So the localization problem is, in fact, due to background independence. And it's quite well understood the way in which we can address the localization problem using relational observables in classical gravity. A little bit less on the quantum gravity side, especially, and this is especially true for this kind of quantum gravity theories like group field theories, where again, our fundamental degrees of freedom are only weakly related to space time quantities, which are expected to emerge from these degrees of freedom only after a continuum limit is taken. So, the reason why we should expect this to be the case, we should expect additional complications for this kind of theories, is because the quantities whose localization we would like to describe relationally are now the result of a prior coarse graining or some fundamental use of freedom. Or in other words, the way we know how to implement the relational strategy or construct relational observables comes from our continuum intuition. So we need to perform some coarse graining if you want to implement the same kind of ideas in our quantum gravity theories. So there's the continuum limit problem and the localization problem are somehow intertwined one with another, as we see in this case here, and also with the problem of the randomization scale that I mentioned before. So again, effective approaches might be particularly useful for this. And let me clarify a little bit what I mean by this, which is that as we said before, we've seen that there are different phases of the theory. We could have pre-geometric and proto-geometric phases. So of course, if we want to rely on our continuum intuitions, we would like to define our effective approach in the proto-geometric phase, so where we can use collective observables and coarse-grained states. And of course, if we had to choose between implementing this strategy perspective neutral way or perspective dependent way, it would be ideal to do that in a perspective neutral way, because in that case, we can actually study processes of quantum covariance and things like that. But we would also like to, the other important requirement that we would like to impose is that our effective approach is in fact effective. So we want our relational localization to hold only on average. So with our internal frame not to be too quantum. So let me clarify a little bit what I have in mind here with a simple example of a scalar field clock. So the fact that we want to work at this proto-geometric level means that we should be able to identify some states which admit some form of continuum or proto-geometric intuition, and a set of observables which under expectation value on these states can be associated to geometric observables or scalar field observables, or we could also have completely different observables from the continuum one, like the number of quanta. And the requirement of effectiveness means that there should exist a Hamiltonian that generates this average evolution of our, for instance, geometric observables with respect to the expectation value of our clock field. And if we want to effectively deparameterize the system, we also want the moments of this Hamiltonian to coincide with those of the momentum of the scalar fields that generate translation along the scalar field. But all of this only makes sense, of course, if the fluctuations on the clock are small. Otherwise, this equation, of course, it wouldn't make a lot of sense. And in order to characterize that, we would need to actually compute, it's a very difficult statement to characterize in general because we would have to compute an infinite number of moments. But there are some situations in which these moments actually satisfy a hierarchy, and the higher and higher moments are suppressed by higher and higher powers of the inverse powers of the number operator. in which case you can actually just look at the lowest moment, and if that is smaller than one, then you're guaranteed that all your quantum fluctuations are small. This is something that we will see in the applications in a moment. So so we've seen how to address the continuum limit and relational problem by using effective methods, which was mean field theory and these effective relational approaches. So let me show you now how we can implement both these effective approaches by using some states within a particular class of states within the context of group field theories. So the kind of states that we want to consider are really the simplest form of collective states that we can think of, which are essentially coherent states. And the good thing about coherent states is that when the interactions are small, the dynamics that their condensed wave function or coherent wave function satisfies is just a mean field dynamics. So coherent states are, in fact, another way of rewriting our mean field approximation. But they also allow us to implement an effective relational strategy, because at the level of observable averages. So for instance, suppose that our scalar fields here, that we have four of them, and we want to use them as a physical frame. Now, if we assume that the condensed wave function factorizes into a peaking function, which is fixed and peaks on some arbitrary value of our physical frame, and a reduced wave function, which instead is determined dynamically through these mean field equations, then expectation value of operators on these states would just be functionals of the reduced wave function localized here at the point of peaking that I called x mu. But this x mu has a very clear physical meaning because it's nothing but the expectation value of your physical frame operator. So as an example here, we can see the number operator just counts the number of group field theory quanta in your state. And its expectation value on our condensed states will become just an integral over our group theoretic variables of the modulus of the condensed wave function now localized at the point x mu, which is just the expectation value of our physical frame. So essentially, what we're trying to construct here are effectively relational observables. And through these states, we can actually extract some cosmological physics. So let me show you a little bit of this by starting first at the level of the homogeneous and isotropic sector. So we want to impose the conditions of homogeneity and isotropy at the level of our macroscopic variables, so at the level of our mean field. So we require essentially the condensed wave function to only depend on a minimally coupled masses and free clock. So that's our requirement of homogeneity. The requirement of isotropy is a little bit more technical to impose. But if you look at these kind of states here, you see that the kind of data that are representing a quantum tetrahedron are also the same kind of data that are encoded in the condensed wave function. So you can impose isotropy by requiring that the data of the equivalent quantum tetrahedron are as isotropic as possible. And this essentially makes you collapse all the representational labels that your condensed wave function would depend upon into one single representation label, which is either an alpha integer for EPRL models or a real quantity for Baryk-Cray models. We're also requiring that we work in a regime where interactions are small, in which case our equations become like this for the condensed wave function. And coming back to Bianca's question, here's where you're parameterizing all the unknown dependents on the group information of the coupling of the scalar field. And you can, of course, compute, as we said before, expectation values of observables on these states. As an example, here we consider the volume operator, which is enough to capture the relevant physics of a homogeneous isotropic universe. And you can see that the form is very similar to the form that the number of quanta operator takes under expectation value, because it's really, again, an integral or a sum if you go to representation label of over all possible representation labels of your condensed wave function squared. But in this case, it's weighted by some eigenvalue of the volume operator. So as the number of quanta grows, the volume of the universe grows. And if we know the dynamics of the condensed wave function, we'll know also the dynamics of the volume. So the dynamics of the volume looks like this. And there are two important regimes in which this dynamics significantly simplifies. The first is where the number of quanta is quite large, which again means that the volume is also large and corresponds to late relational times. And in this regime, you can show that exactly because the number of quanta is very, very large, quantum fluctuations on the volume are also very small because they are suppressed by these higher inverse powers of the number of quanta. And in this limit, if one of these mu parameters here, which are again microscopic parameters related to this, is only mildly dependent on the representation labels and equal to 3 pi g, you can get your flat Freeman Robertson-Wolkin dynamics. On top of that, you can also see that your effective relational framework is reliable because this x-naught is in fact the expectation value of your scalar field clock. Clock quantum fluctuations are small because, again, they're suppressed by higher power of the number operator. And your system is effectively deparametrized. And in fact, another important result is that this classical limit seems to be universal in the sense that it doesn't seem to depend a lot on the details of the model that has been considered.
If you say negligible interactions, does it mean you neglect the gluing? The interaction, the gluing.
You're essentially neglecting the gluing of the tetraeder to form a four simplex, or some kind of higher dimensional cellular complex.
Meaning these are freely floating tetrahedra?
These are freely floating tetrahedra, like from the point of view of the state, because it was a condensate state, right? And the condensate state doesn't have any entanglement. So these are really unentangled states, uncorrelated states that are just floating in space. But this, I think this makes particular sense if you want to look for homogeneous situations. But as I will show you in a moment, when we go to the inhomogeneous case, things will have to be different. In that case, things will change a lot.
I have a question about what mu v is. Sorry, I missed that.
Yeah, so it's a
it's
a combination of this parameter and this pi tilde 0 squared, which is essentially a quantity that enters,
and then it enters what the...
in the peaking function that we've defined here. So it's a phase of the peaking function, and that enters in the mu.
So you haven't defined it?
Here, no, I haven't defined it, yeah. It's a parameter that defines the phase of the peaking function. But it effectively only enters in this mu parameter as a combination together with this e parameter.
The
e parameter instead is the parameter that comes essentially from what I was mentioning before to Bianca, so the fact that when you write the kinetic kernel, that will have a very complicated dependence on the group theoretic data. Then you manage, through this choice of peak states, you manage to actually expand that kinetic kernel into higher order derivatives with respect to your scalar field. And these higher order derivatives of the scalar field all come with a prefactor, which is depending on the group theoretic data only, because you have expanded on the scalar field data. So when you put everything together, this E factor is essentially a ratio between different powers, different prefactors that come in different terms of the expansion of the kinetic kernel in derivatives of with respect to the scalar field. So in a sense, yes, what I was saying before is that it's really a parameterized setting. So it's complicated to see what is the exact geometric dependence of this object starting from the fundamental theory. This is a really problem. And I mean, that is most likely one of the reasons why we're seeing this kind of universal behavior, because we're somehow working with similarly parametrized theories. But then, yeah, which actually connects me to the second point, which is the question of what happens if we instead go at earlier times. This is particularly important because if we look at the average evolution of the volume here, for a large range of initial conditions, there's a singularity resolution into a quantum bound, so the volume never vanishes. And these initial conditions depend on the kind of model that you're using. So the point at which the bounce happens and all the details of the bounce are actually depending a lot on the kind of model that you're using. But again, the question is, what happens because we're going now to earlier and earlier times, we're working with smaller and smaller number of quanta. So it could happen in this regime, quantum fluctuations on the volume become large. And similarly, so that we can't actually rely on this average description of the universe, because higher moments of the volume will become important. And at the same time, our effective relational framework may break down for several different reasons that we've been able to quantify. And all of this eventually depends on how large is the number of quanta at the moment of the bounce. If this is quite large or not, it's what determines whether or not we can understand the singularity resolution in this average sense, or if we need to actually take into account higher order quantum fluctuations. So again, here, yes, just to tie back to your question, yes, this is where I believe that some differences between different models could be characterized. So different times at which the bounce happens, different features of the bounce, yeah. So far I've shown you that we can actually extract some cosmological physics from some specific choice of states, which were satisfying the requirement that we put forward in the first part of the talk. But in fact, the natural question is to ask if it is possible to extract similar physics, but without having to specify to some given choice of states, but rather to a larger class of states which just satisfy some generic conditions. And there's a way in which one can implement the relational strategy effectively in a state-agnostic way, which is a framework that was developed by Bojewald and collaborators for quantum systems. And essentially, the basic idea here is that you're trading off your quantum properties of your quantum mechanical system for a phase space, which is called quantum phase space, which is infinite dimensional. And if you have a quantum constraint, that you will trade off that for an infinitely many effective constraints. You will have, of course, then you will have all these infinite dimensional objects. And in order to actually do computations, you will need to impose a truncation scheme. So for instance, you can require your states to be as semiclassical as possible. So you can actually truncate at the lowest order of your moments that are supposed to satisfy a hierarchy because of this semiclassicality condition. And then in this kind of situation, you can develop a strategy to actually rewrite your system in a relational manner with respect to your clock that is made as classical as possible. So the question is, can we apply a framework like this in the context of field theory? Well, we have obvious complications. Of course, the fact that we have infinitely many algebra generators and infinitely many quantum constraints in the context of field theory. So of course, this framework cannot be implemented straightforwardly, but there may be some situations where the system that we're considering is so coarse that in fact it's just characterized by a small number of observables, so that we can replace our infinitely many quantum constraint with just one integrated quantum constraint, and our infinitely many infinitely generated algebra observables just by a minimal set of physically relevant observables. This should be expected to be the case for cosmology, so one can try to redo the same analysis in group field theory. And looking again for cosmological applications. And what happens is that if you do the same analysis with this, using now this k variable as a clock variable, which is a counterpart of the classical curvature, then you can write the evolution of the scalar field now with respect to curvature. And this will be in agreement with classical cosmology. But now if you look at the fluctuations, and if they require them to be small at small curvature, so late times, they will also stay small at large curvature, so at early times. And this is completely different from what we've seen before, right? Because we've seen that at early times, quantum fluctuations could become important because of this number of quanta that was changing. But in this case, we have truncated the system so much that the number of quanta is always constant. So what we're doing is essentially our truncation is so strong that we're missing some complexity. So as we go at earlier and earlier times where we expect this complexity to become important, we're kind of missing important ingredients. Nonetheless, this is a way to actually study the continuum, the classical limit rather than the singularity resolution. And it's a way in which we can actually read the strategy, but in terms of a clock, a geometric clock rather than a matter clock.
Okay, 10 minutes.
Perfect. So finally, let me tell you something about the inhomogeneous sector, which I spoiled a little bit before. And the kind of inhomogeneous cosmological system that we have in mind is a very, very simple system, which is made of four minimally coupled Masterson-free reference fields that we want to use as a physical reference frame, and one minimally coupled masses matter field that I'm calling matter field because it's expected to be dominating the energy momentum budget of the universe and to be slightly relation homogeneous with respect to our rods. Now, when we want to construct the corresponding quantum gravity system, we want to follow two basic principles. The first is that we want to perform a coupling of our physical reference frame, which is which respect the causal properties of our frame. So a rod should stay a rod, and a clock should stay a clock. The other important requirement that we want to pose is that the inhomogeneous parts of our cosmological geometries should come from the perspective of our quantum gravity theory from quantum gravity correlations. And this is of course, motivated by the idea that non-trivial geometries should arise from quantum entanglement. So let me show you how these principles can be implemented in the context of group field theory. So the starting point is a model where you actually have access to both time-like and space-like quanta. And the causal character of this quanta is characterized by this normal to the tetrahedron. So we consider a group field theory which is made of both space-like and time-like quanta. And the kinetic term of this group field theory is just a sum over the space-like and the time-like part. Now, the requirement that our clocks propagate only along time-like edges, so equivalently along space-like tetrahedra, means that k minus should be independent on our clock, because k minus tells us how propagation is encoded into time-like tetrahedra, so space-like edges. And the similar thing happens with k plus and the rods, similar but opposite. So this is the way in which we're implementing the causal requirements on our group field theory. And the second requirement instead is that we want to introduce these inhomogeneities coming from quantum correlations. And so we need to go beyond coherent states. So in a sense, we still want collective states, but our states are not going to be just these coherent state parts here, which are the same that we've seen before, but just also for a space-like and now a time-like condensate. But there's going to be some additional terms that are the squeezing operators here, which generate entanglement between space-like and space-like tetrahedra, space-like and time-like tetrahedra, and time-like and time-like tetrahedra. So these are going to be our inhomogeneities, are going to be encoded into these functions here. And we're also going to assume for simplicity that these functions are going to represent correlation between relationally nearest neighbor tetrahedra. So you can run the mean field analysis that we've seen before also in this case. It is quite more involved, but an important thing is that you have now two mean field equations for three quantities of first order, so there's some dynamical freedom. But if you look at the dynamics of these observables, as we've seen before, of observables of interest, which you can split into background parts and perturbations, with the perturbations depending on these kernels here. So if you look at the dynamics of these objects at late times, and you require that this matches the classical dynamics in an appropriate limit, this fixes completely this additional dynamical freedom. And how does this dynamic look like? Well, for the matter variable, matter perturbation and a curvature-like perturbation, the dynamics is exactly that of GR, which is this left-hand side here. But there are also some corrections which come suppressed by the ratio between the momentum and the Planck mass. So these are really Trans-Planckian corrections to the dynamics. And you can see this here. You can see a plot between the group field theory and GR curvature perturbation dynamics, which are perfectly superimposed. But if you look a little bit closer here in the difference, you can see that there's a difference, but just for modes which are 10 to the 2 times Planck mass. So they're really, really highly energetic modes. Highly energetic modes. So we can see that there are Trans-Planckian corrections to these dynamics, while there's a good agreement with GR at larger scales. So So with these results, we really, I think, clarify what Bianca said before. So the question of where, when do we need entanglement? And we do need it if we want to study inhomogeneities. And through these kind of states, we're also able, and with this kind of mean field dynamics, we're also able to extract the effective dynamics of these perturbations from our full quantum gravity, from our full quantum gravity theory. So let me summarize briefly what I said today. So we started from the left-hand side of the diagram, and we went to the right-hand side of the diagram. We discussed a little bit of the problems that we're facing when going from left to right. We talked about the coarse graining problem. We discussed an effective approach to address the coarse graining problem through the mean field approximation. We've noticed that the mean field approximation is remarkably better in quantum gravity than it is in standard quantum field theory due to the Lorentzian properties of, well, hyperbolic properties of the Lorentz group. And we've studied also the problem of localization. We've implemented some effective approaches to the relational strategy. And we've seen the interplay between relational strategy and quantum effects, especially when studying the singularity resolution. We noticed then that there's a universal classical limit in cosmology that seems to come from these kind of models that we've explored also with different clocks. And finally, at the level of inhomogeneities, we were able to understand the emergence of these cosmological inhomogeneities as coming from quantum entanglement between quantum or fundamental quantum gravity theory. And we were able to derive the dynamics from our full quantum gravity theory, finding that it matches GR at low energies, but there are some Transplanckian corrections for higher energies. So let me just conclude by telling you a few things that I'm working on and some things that I would like to work on in the future. So going back to the effective approach that I mentioned before, as I said, what we did was not to generalize it to field theory, but that I believe would be something extremely interesting, because for instance, it would allow us to understand better the role of quantum reference frames or generalize the idea of quantum reference frames to field theories, to quantum field theories. And we're working on that by constructing a quantum covariant phase space using m-particle reducible techniques. And this framework seems to be naturally adapted to also study boundaries, so it could help us also make a more direct connection between quantum reference frames and edge modes. Another thing that we're working on that I think it's interesting is to try and give a relational interpretation to the randomization group scale. And a natural framework in which this could be done is the context of asymptotic safety framework. And finally, another thing that I'm trying to work on right now is to construct relational observables in full group field theory by using POVMs, because we're trying to construct them in such a way that they really encode the physics of relational observables so that they really capture the value of a certain quantity when another quantity is measured to have a certain value, which is where the POVMs actually enter. And instead, regarding the continuum limit problem, we've seen that there are some form of universalities in the result that we found. So it would be interesting to see what kind of effective models produce these universal features. And a good starting point, I think, would be to construct the corresponding group field theory models of the effective spinform models that have been developed here. And it would be extremely interesting to see if these effective models would then come as a result of some appropriate coarse graining. So studying the normalization properties of EPRL or some particular geometric models. And to do that, it would be interesting to import techniques, for instance, from spinforms by using tensor network randomization techniques, which seem particularly suited for group field theories because, in fact, our states are generalization of tensor networks. And also try to understand better the refinement or continuum limit of amplitudes in group field theory, because I feel like we do have the technology to address that by using refinement operators that were already defined in group field theory and the mean field analysis that I showed today. And also I'm trying to work on making the connection between loop quantum gravity, spin forms, and group field theory a little bit more concrete by working on some toy models like the HK model, but also working by looking at the average imposition of the Hamiltonian constraint in loop quantum gravity on the Fock space version of the loop quantum gravity diff-invariant Hilbert space, and compare it to the mean field dynamics of group field theory. So all of this could help then, if we develop some new techniques in group field theory, to actually import them back to these other approaches. And finally, let me conclude by telling very quickly what I would like to do in cosmology, because there's a result that I didn't actually have time to mention, which is the fact that if we include interactions in our group field theory models, especially order six interactions, there seems to be a generic acceleration phase that is generated by these interactions. And for some models, this acceleration produces a slow roll inflationary phase. So it would be interesting to see if there are phenomenological consequences of this, in particular if these kind of interactions could also produce an early dark energy component that could help alleviating the H-naught tension. And at the level of the results that we already have on cosmological perturbations, the most straightforward thing to do would be to implement them at the level of the standard cosmological models and look if there are phenomenological consequences of that. But the ideal thing to do would be to construct a full cosmological perturbation theory from group field theory, which means studying more observables, introducing more realistic matter like dust, radiation, and then understand where the primordial Poiseuille spectrum or the Bunch-Davis vacuum comes from the perspective of our underlying quantum gravity theory. And finally, the analysis so far has been only devoted to late-ish times. But we've also studied the behavior of superhorizon modes closer to the bounds, and it seems that the dynamics of these modes doesn't match with any modified gravity theory, which maybe signals some breakdown of effective field theory. It's something that we're not still sure about. But it would be interesting also to see what happens if we move beyond the superhorizon modes and include also spatial perturbations, so that they, and see if they could actually suppress or enhance chaotic behavior in this regime. So yeah, a lot of things that I would like to work on that I'm really excited about. So yeah, thank you very much for your attention.
You mentioned that you get busy with the GFT cosmology, basically the same dynamics as in GR.
Yeah.
So which cosmology?
Yeah.
Is it
k equal to 0, 1, minus? Yes, it's k equal to 0. I don't know if I mentioned this. If I didn't, I'm sorry. Here it's a flat, and with flat I meant k equal to 0. And also, as I was saying, these are very simple cosmological models, because they're the only kind of matter contact are these scalar fields. So if you want to make contact, really, from our full quantum gravity theory, with cosmological observations, we need to include dust, radiation, and all these kind of things.
Cosmological
constant, it depends if we have to add it by hand or if it will come from the interactions. That's the other thing. So far, there's no cosmological constant. But yeah, what I was saying here is that this cosmic acceleration phase that seems to be produced by interactions could generate both an early phase of acceleration, but also late times acceleration. So it could either produce inflation or a cosmological constant at late times. This is something that needs to be explored. Daniele and a student of it, they have a paper where they show that these kind of interactions actually produce a phantom-like cosmological constant at late times. But there's more work to do on that point to actually understand the phenomenological consequences of these kind of interactions.
Thank you. K equal to 1, is it possible? Or?
Yeah, that's
K equal to 0 is a...
That's another good question. So there are some ways in which you can the K different from 0 could emerge in two ways. Either because we have some particular kind of interactions that in the end effectively produce a behavior similar to curvature, which would be a similar mechanism here from the cosmological to the cosmological constant case. One could also try to study states which are coherent but with a different topology. So like dipole states, which would have the topology of a closed space. And then one could run again the mean field analysis as we did before and see if this leads instead to a k equal to 1, for instance, cosmology. This is also something that we haven't done. We've been talking about doing it since a while, but we haven't been doing it yet.
question. I actually have a question. It wasn't that much clear to me the way you were talking about relational observable and the idea you have to go from some micro to macro. I'm not very familiar, so can you give me a broader picture of what you mean by relational observable in general?
Yeah, so I would say that the easiest way, like a way in which we can talk about relational observables in a context where, like in group field theory, where we don't necessarily have access to like an Hamiltonian constraint, at least not explicitly, is really by constructing observables which encode the same physics of a relational observable. So observables which tell you a value of a quantity, whether another quantity is measured to have a certain value. So that would be the physical content of a relational observable, right? Without making reference of the mathematical structure that you need to actually construct it, that would be the physical content. And that's the direction that we're exploring here with this construction in terms of POVMs, because we're constructing POVMs. Maybe I can actually show you something. So the idea is to construct these scarf field clock POVMs. And POVMs in quantum field theory are a mess to construct, but because the point is that when you construct a quantity that is supposed to perform or represent a measurement process in quantum field theory, what you're measuring is the field itself. In our case, what we're trying to measure is one value of the scalar field, which is part of the domain of the field. So this makes it a little bit simpler to construct POVMs. So you can construct this awful looking object. You can show that it's a POVM. You can show that it's covariant with respect to the momentum of your scalar field. And you can show that the first moment of this POVM is the intensive version of the scalar field, which is exactly what you would do in this POVM's analysis of the problem of time in the context of quantum mechanics. So these POVMs, you can construct them, and then you can try to construct relational observables by acting with your POVM first. So granting that you measured, you performed the measurement in a scalar field clock, and then you act with another operator. So that would be, I think, that's the way in which we're trying to implement construct relational observables without making reference of all the continuum structures that you need. And the point that I was making before is that really all the construction that we're used to somehow rely on having some continuum objects, for instance, the constraint or all these kind of things. And in a context where these things are not particularly clear how they look like, you need to actually extract only the physics and work with only the physics. So that's at least the way in which we're trying to go forward in that direction.
Thanks. Questions? All right, so let's thanks Luca again.